Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by. Welcome to Artisan Partners Asset Management's fourth quarter 2014 earnings conference call. My name is Emily, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the prepared remarks, management will conduct a question-and-answer session, and conference participants will be given instructions at that time. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. At this time, I will turn the call over to Makela Taphorn with Artisan Partners.
Hi, everyone. Before we begin, I would like to remind you that our fourth quarter earnings release and the related presentation materials are available on the investor relations section of our website. I would also like to remind you that comments made on today's call and some of our responses to your questions may deal with forward-looking statements and are subject to risks and uncertainties. Factors that may cause our actual results to differ from expectations are presented in the earnings release and are detailed in our filings with the SEC. We undertake no obligation to revise these statements following the date of this conference call. In addition, some of the remarks this morning or this afternoon include references to non-GAAP financial measures. You can find reconciliations of those measures to the most comparable GAAP measures in the earnings release. With that, I'll now turn the call over to our Chief Executive Officer, Eric Colson.
Thanks, Makela. Welcome to the Artisan Partners Asset Management business update and quarterly earnings call. I'm Eric Colson, CEO, and I'm joined today by CJ Daley, CFO. Thank you for your time today, and I hope you find this discussion useful. The end of 2014 marked our second year as a public company. More importantly, it marked the 20th anniversary of our firm. Having been in business 20 years, if we have learned anything, it's that quarterly and annual business outcomes are less impactful to our success than the long-term strategy and philosophy. During this discussion, I will review our results for the quarter but emphasize the year. I'll reinforce how the business developments that occurred over those short time periods align with our long-term strategy and future plans. Once I'm done, CJ will take the lead and walk through our financials. On the firm's fact page two of the presentation, I will make just two quick comments. First, our overall AUM increased to nearly $108 billion at the end of the year from $106 billion at the end of the third quarter. This change was largely the result of market appreciation. Our net client cash outflows partially offset market gains. I will discuss that further later in the presentation. The second item worth noting is our distribution channel pie chart. Last year, we discussed our logic behind reporting three broad channels instead of the five channels that we historically reported. We are now consolidating the former financial advisor and broker-dealer channels as the intermediary channel, and we rolled the defined contribution channel into our institutional channel. The retail channel remains unchanged. We believe these updated classifications are more appropriate representation of our client base and align better with our distribution model and team structure. Page three highlights the three core principles to define who we are. When our founders established the business plan for our firm 20 years ago, they had a number of perspectives about the investment management business that have shaped our long-term strategy. The first was that we would compete on the merits of our investment acumen. We would not compete on price, distribution strategy, market spend, or a myriad of other things. In short, we would be an investment firm first and foremost. A second perspective was a recognition that the investment management industry is a talent business. Our assets would be our people. We would have to rely on our investment talent to provide a differentiated offering. This shaped our autonomous team structure and drove the decision to have distinct business management team, central operational structure, and aligned business development efforts. We believe that this has allowed our talent to focus on investing, placing them in the best position to succeed. Finally, we have always sought to manage and grow the business thoughtfully. The right clients, asset diversification, and financial discipline are principles that ensure we prioritize the investment process. By applying those principles, we have been able to grow while maintaining the integrity of our business model. Our business has evolved over the past 20 years, but the general perspectives that shaped our business strategy at the founding of the firm have remained intact. We are a high value-added investment firm designed for investment talent to thrive in a thoughtful growth environment. Over the next three pages, I will spend time reviewing our long-term investment results. On page 4, you can see how we analyze investment performance. We look for faithfulness to a stated investment process, solid absolute performance, and attractive performance compared to peers and the index over full cycles. As of December 31st, all of our strategies had followed their objectives with integrity, and all had positive absolute returns since inception. 7 of our 11 investment strategies with at least a 5-year track record added value relative to their broad performance benchmarks over the trailing 5-year period. All 7 of our investment strategies with a 10-year track record added value relative to their broad performance benchmarks. Page 5 adds some additional color to our results by presenting a range of time frames. As of December 31st, more than 80% of our assets under management were in strategies outperforming their respective benchmarks over the trailing 3-year and 5-year periods. Over the trailing 10-year period, 100% of our assets under management were in outperforming strategies. Our 1-year results reflected the difficult environment for active management broadly. I will elaborate on that in a moment. Our mutual fund peer ratings, which are highlighted at the bottom of the page, are a great snapshot of how our results translate into industry-wide rankings from Lipper and Morningstar. Generally speaking, our teams are performing quite well relative to the peers. Well, on the topic of peer results, I want to recognize our Global Value team. For the 4th year in a row, the Global Value team was nominated for Morningstar's International Stock Fund Manager of the Year in the U.S. The team previously won the award in 2008 and 2013, and was also nominated for the award in 2011 and 2012, making this the 5th year in the last 7 that the team has received a nomination. The continued recognition from a high-quality organization like Morningstar is a tremendous accomplishment and testament to the team's efforts and the long-term track record they have produced. On the next page, page 6, I want to spend some additional time talking about the market environment and providing some additional color on our short-term performance results. Let me start by saying that short-term performance outcomes are driven by numerous factors. It would be disingenuous to imply that results are entirely or even mostly impacted by external factors. They certainly haven't been. But if our teams are maintaining a consistent investment process, on occasion, the market environment can cause one or more of our teams to experience what we consider an exaggerated outcome. In 2014, one of the market factors that had exaggerated impact on performance was momentum. You can see by the table on the left side of the page that in the year when the market, represented here as the Russell 3000, was up about 12%, the range of possible outcomes, depending on a portfolio's exposure to stocks in the top or bottom momentum quintile, was significant. The stocks in the first quintile outperformed the stocks in the bottom quintile by more than 50 percentage points in this example. None of our strategies had either full exposure or no exposure to stocks with momentum characteristics, but some strategies were more skewed than others. Underexposure to momentum stocks had a particularly large impact on our U.S. value team, most notably in their small and mid-cap value strategies. That team gravitates towards fear and uncertainty when they invest. The result is the team's new investment ideas are often downtrodden stocks that are often priced near their 52-week lows. Those are not momentum stocks. Market-wide, the momentum factor is one of the factors that generally resulted in passive investing realizing better outcomes than active investing over the last year. More money moving towards winners will do that. Another phenomenon that hurt active strategy was the divergence in performance of in and out of benchmark stocks. Active investors tend to look for the best long-term opportunities anywhere. Passive indexes just own the benchmark. Our teams are generally agnostic about whether a holding is in the benchmark or out. When money is flowing into passive strategies, the performance of benchmark names benefits and the relative performance of non-benchmark names suffer. Portfolios with significant exposure to non-benchmark holdings will generally underperform. This has had an impact on the recent performance of our U.S. value team portfolios, and it has had a large impact on the performance of our emerging markets team for a while now. Finally, before moving on, I just want to highlight the importance of a full cycle view. Since April of 2009, stocks have consistently trended higher. with the bull market now approaching 6 years, 3 and 5 year performance results only reflect performance during a bull market. We assess the success of our teams over full cycles, which should include a bull and a bear market. We believe that's a more instructive way of assessing investment performance. Take the chart on the right of the page. The chart is looking at two time periods, the bear market from April 2008 through March 2009, and the bull market that is extended from April 2009 to the end of 2014. The left column illustrates how managers that were in the top quintile relative to peers during the bear market has performed relative to peers in the current bull market. The right column illustrates how managers that were in the bottom quintile during the bear market have performed relative to peers in the current bull market. With exception of the large cap categories at the bottom of the table, managers that retain capital well in the bear market are trailing peers in the current bull market, particularly those that struggled during the bear market. The U.S. small cap value and U.S. mid cap value categories have especially exaggerated differences. What this suggests is the characteristics of the current bull market have not favored managers that performed very well relative to peers in the bear market of April of 2008 to March of 2009. We believe this further strengthens the case for a full market cycle view when assessing investment performance. Page 7 illustrates the outcomes of our business discipline around asset diversification. The most notable shifts in assets over the year took place across our investment teams and client domicile. For the quarter, 3 of our 6 investment teams experienced positive client cash flows, and 4 of the teams saw positive client cash flows over the full year. It was a strong year for our global equity team due largely to a high level of interest in the team's non-U.S. growth strategy and early interest in the global small cap strategy. Our growth team also had a solid year due to growing demand for its global opportunity strategy. The global value team was positive, but cash flows were muted because the two strategies they manage are closed. Our U.S. value and emerging markets team experienced flow pressure as performance results impacted some of our asset base on those teams. On the bottom right, you will notice the firm's assets from clients outside of the U.S. continue to grow and represent a larger portion of our client base. Non-U.S. flows were positive for the quarter and year. I'd like to elaborate on this part of the business on the next page. On page 8, we pulled together some brief statistics about the evolution of our non-U.S. distribution efforts. As shown on the chart, this is a business we committed to a little over 5 years ago. We put a strategy in place and had some general goals in mind, but we knew that progress would take time. We don't believe a distribution strategy can be successfully executed in haste, at least not one without significant investment. And financial discipline has been one of our core principles since our founding. We believe that deliberate, thoughtful decisions result in the best long-term outcomes, and we are starting to see that with our results outside the U.S. For several years, we have been knocking on doors and picking up the phone to introduce our brand directly with potential clients, at conferences, and through press interaction. In a year when our U.S. distribution results were muted, we saw the benefits of all that work. Assets grew, we had solid net client cash flows, our number of relationships increased, and we delivered high-quality results for our clients. This has been a nice build that reflects our long-term diversification strategy. I look forward to continuing to report on our developments overseas as we are just scratching the surface. Turning to page 9 and 10, I thought I would close with thoughts about our capital structure and investment talent. During the quarter and year, our capital structure stayed largely the same. External ownership has shifted with the sale of Hellman & Friedman's stake to public investors. Employees own about a third of the economics of the business, and their access to liquidity is occurring in a structured way. Many of our founding investors who have had the right to sell their interest since our IPO remain significant owners in our business. One change worth re-emphasizing is our post-IPO equity grants. We have an equity ownership culture at our firm to encourage a long-term mindset, retain key talent, and align the interests of our employees with clients and shareholders. In 2014, we introduced the concept of career shares to complement awards of standard restricted shares. Standard shares vest over a five-year schedule, with 20% of the award vesting in each of the 5 years after the grant. This is a traditional structure. For career shares, vesting is similar to our historical rules. In general, career shares only vest upon the satisfaction of both pro rata time vesting, like the standard shares, and a qualifying retirement. For a qualifying retirement, the recipient must have at least 10 years with Artisan at retirement, and for portfolio managers and named executive officers, must have given us their 3-year notice in advance. Other employees receive career shares must give 1-year notice in order to have a qualifying retirement. There are exceptions to these terms, but we think career shares will enhance the stability of our firm by increasing our ability to retain our key people. My final page, slide 10, is a quick depiction of our investment teams. 20 years ago, we had one dot located in Milwaukee. As we have grown to 6 teams over the years, you can see the impact of our business model has had on our locations. We resource our teams in a way that supports their unique investment processes. Our decision to allow our teams to establish their franchise where they feel they can do their best work is just one aspect of our investment culture. Each team's analysts organized in a unique way. Each team's products reflect our work with them to align their investment research with sophisticated investors' demand, and the size of each team's business is determined by the level at which they believe they can invest most successfully. We have called out our newest team here because we have spent a fair amount of time with Brian Krug over the last year doing all those things I just mentioned. And it has been a unique build-out. Just as each of our teams were different build-outs, Brian has established a credit team of 3 analysts and a trader fully dedicated to the Artisan High Income Strategy, which launched in 2014. All team members are located in our new Kansas City office, which is the location Brian selected. We have seen some early asset raising success for the credit team, but we have done so with very minimal involvement from Brian. He and his team are focused on investing. That concludes my prepared remarks. I will turn it over to CJ to go through the financials.
Thanks, Eric. Good morning, everyone. The December quarter marked the end of our calendar and fiscal 2014 year. For the year, our results were very strong when compared to the full year of 2013. Revenues for the year were up 21% from calendar 2013, reflecting an increase in average AUM of 21%. Adjusted operating income for the calendar 2014 was $371.7 million, or a 44.9% adjusted operating margin. The first two quarters of calendar 2014 were strong, as flows into active strategies were robust, and at Artisan, we had strong flows from international mandates in the intermediary space. That activity trailed off in the last half of 2014, and we ended the year with 2 consecutive quarters of modest net outflows. Specifically, we experienced net outflows of $538 million in the fourth quarter of 2014, ending the year at $107.9 billion in AUM. Revenues for the December 2014 quarter were $206 million, down 3% from September 2014 quarter, and up 4% from the December quarter in 2013. Adjusted operating income in the December 2014 quarter was $90.4 million, also down 3% from the September 2014 quarter, and up 7% from the fourth quarter of 2013. We move into 2015, encouraged by the strong performance and continued client interest in our non-U.S. growth, global equity, global opportunities, and high income strategies, but cautious as performance challenges in several of our strategies remain and the headwinds we experienced in the last half of 2014 continue into 2015. A summary of our fourth quarter and full year 2014 financial results is on slide 11. For the quarter, ending AUM increased 2% to $107.9 billion. The increase was driven by market appreciation, partially offset by net client cash outflows of $538 million. Although ending AUM was up during the quarter, our average AUM decreased 3% quarter over quarter, with market depreciation experienced early in the quarter driving the decline. Consistent with the decrease in average AUM, revenues for the December quarter were $206 million, down 3% from revenues in the preceding September quarter of 2014. Our adjusted operating margin for December 2014 quarter was 43.9%, which was in line with our prior quarter's adjusted operating margin of 44%. Net income on an adjusted per share basis was 76 cents compared to 79 cents per adjusted share in the September quarter. For the calendar year, ending AUM increased 2% to $107.9 billion, up from $105.5 billion at the end of calendar 2013. Average AUM, however, was up significantly in calendar 2014. Average AUM rose 21% to $107.9 billion. Revenue and adjusted operating income correspondingly rose 21% and 29%, respectively. Our adjusted operating margin for the calendar year was 44.9%, up from 42.1% in 2013. Adjusted earnings per adjusted share were $33.17, up from $2.54 in 2013. Yesterday, we announced a regular quarterly dividend of 60 cents per share. This represents a 9% increase from our regular quarterly dividends paid in 2014. Our board of directors also declared a special annual dividend of 95 cents per share, which represents a distribution of our remaining 2014 adjusted earnings and some excess cash. Slide 12 details our AUM and client cash flows. Ending assets under management of $107.9 billion for the December quarter were up 2% from September 2014 quarter, as we continue to see outflows resulting from institutional clients profit-taking, rebalancing, asset allocation decisions, and relative underperformance in certain strategies. In addition, our U.S. mutual funds made their annual income and capital gains distribution in November, which resulted in net client cash outflows of $648 million from clients who chose not to reinvest their dividends. These outflows were offset in part by net client cash inflows into our non-U.S. growth and global opportunity strategies, with flows coming from both institutions and intermediaries. Looking over a longer period, and as you know, we like to stress longer-term views than quarterly periods, our December 2014 ending AUM was up 2% compared to AUM at the end of December 2013. Market appreciation contributed $1.7 billion, or 1.6% of this growth, with the remaining growth attributable to net client inflows, particularly strategies managed by our global equity, growth, and credit teams. We also experienced significant early flows into our global value strategy, which is now closed to new investments. Average AUM for the year of $107.9 billion was up 20% from $89.5 billion in 2013. Slide 13 highlights our non-U.S. client AUM, which was $13.9 billion at the end of 2014, up from $13 billion at the end of September quarter and up 17% from a year ago. The increase in non-U.S. client AUM was primarily due to net client cash inflows into our global opportunity strategy as well as market appreciation. Client demand outside of the U.S. remains strong for certain of our strategies, particularly global opportunities. Our financial results begin on slide 14. For the December 2014 quarter, revenues were $206 million on average AUM of $106.9 billion. The 3% decline in revenues quarter over quarter is in line with our decline in average AUM, but is a 4% increase in revenues from the corresponding December 2013 quarter. We have a handful of clients with performance-based fees, most of which accrue in the December quarter. Performance fees in the December 2014 quarter were $700,000, down from $2.5 million in the corresponding 2013 quarter. For the year ended December 31, 2014, revenues were $828.7 million on average AUM of $107.9 billion, up 21% from revenues of $685.8 million on average AUM of $89.5 billion for the year ended December 2013. Our weighted average management fee for the December quarter was 76 basis points, and for the year ended 77 basis points. Turning to slide 15, our adjusted operating margin, which excludes pre-offering share-based compensation and other GAAP expenses, was 43.9% for the December quarter, compared to 44% in the September 2014 quarter and 42.9% in the fourth quarter of 2013. Our adjusted operating margin declined slightly to a full quarter of equity-based comp expense related to our July 2014 employee equity grant. Adjusted net income for the December 2014 quarter was $55.5 million, or 76 per adjusted share, which is a 3% decline from the September quarter and a 1% increase over the December 2013 quarter. For the year ended December 31, 2014, our adjusted operating margin was 44.9%, up from 42.1% for the year ended December 2013. This increase in adjusted operating margin was the result of higher revenues and a decrease in cash retention and severance expenses, partially offset by an increase in compensation expense as a result of the employee equity awards and incentive compensation, and an increase in distribution and marketing expenses. For 2014, adjusted earnings per adjusted share was $3.17, up 25% from $2.54 in December 2013 year. Slide 16 highlights our compensation ratio. Our compensation expense in the current December quarter continues to include the amortization of pre-IPO equity compensation, which we adjust out of expenses when calculating our adjusted operating margin and adjusted earnings per adjusted share. Our compensation expense for the December quarter also includes a full quarter of amortization of our July 2014 equity grants, which increased our quarterly expense for post-IPO equity awards to $7.7 million, as we discussed on our previous earnings call. Also, as indicated on our previous call, we have moved our annual equity grant cycle to a calendar year basis. Accordingly, at the end of January, our board approved a prorated six-month grant of 621,000 shares of restricted stock to certain members of our investment teams. Including that grant, we expect the total equity-based compensation expense to be approximately $8 million in the March 2015 quarter. Beginning in June 2015 quarter, we expect the full quarterly run rate of equity-based comp expense to be approximately $9 million. Keep in mind that that run rate includes amortization with respect to 2.5 annual grants since our IPO. Of course, the cost of future equity-based awards is largely dependent upon the size of future grants and the stock price at the time of grant. Slide 17 shows our balance sheet highlights. Our balance sheet remains strong. Our cash balance is healthy, ending the December quarter at $182.3 million, which was down 14% from $211.8 million at December 31, 2013. Our cash balance at December 31, 2013 included a portion of cash proceeds from our IPO offering, which we were distributed through our special annual dividend paid in the first quarter of 2014. At December 31, 2014, our stockholders' equity was $107.5 million, down $25 million compared to December 2013, primarily as a result of the liquidation of Launch Equity, a consolidated investment vehicle. Nearly all of Launch Equity's capital was attributable to non-controlling interests. Our debt remained at $200 million, and our leverage ratio is 0.5 times EBITDA. As you are aware, our employee partners are restricted from selling more than 15% of their pre-IPO equity in any one-year period. The one-year period will reset in March, at which time the employee partners will have the right to sell, in the aggregate, approximately 3.3 million Class A common shares. They are not required to sell any shares, and we don't know how many shares they will choose to sell. Depending on employee partner interest, we may consider conducting a coordinated offering similar to the offering we conducted in March of last year to provide partners with liquidity. The last slide summarizes our dividends. Our board of directors has declared our regularly quarterly dividend of 60 cents per share. This represents a 9% increase from our regular quarterly dividends paid in 2014. Our board has also declared a special annual dividend of 95 cents per share. Both dividends, a total of $1.55 per share, are payable on February 27, 2015, to shareholders of record as of February 13, 2015. As a reminder, the special annual dividend a year ago includes excess cash raised in the company's IPO, so this year's special annual dividend is less than the prior year due to the absence of that excess IPO cash. Finally, looking forward to 2015, I want to remind you that throughout our history, our growth has been lumpy and has come from certain strategies and teams during distinct pockets of time. We continue to remain focused on growing in a responsible and thoughtful manner that prioritizes our investment talent and their investment processes. Looking ahead, we continue to be encouraged by client interests in our non-U.S. growth, global equity, global opportunities, and high-income strategies, although we will expect we will continue to face headwinds stemming from institutional reallocation decisions and relative performance challenges in certain of our strategies. From a financial perspective, for the March quarter of 2015, we expect an increase in compensation expense given our first quarterly equity grant, as well as seasonal expenses such as employer-funded retirement and healthcare contributions and payroll taxes. Historically, these seasonal costs have added approximately $3 to $4 million to our first quarter expense of each calendar year. In addition, we expect to continue our measured investments in technology to support our investment teams, distribution efforts, and scalable operations, bringing our expected quarterly run rate for communications and technology to approximately $6 to $7 million per quarter. Over time, which may be several quarters or years, we believe these continued investments in our business and talent will be rewarded by long-term growth in AUM and revenues. Our model has been designed for long-term success, and it enables us to continue to produce predictable earnings, meaningful returns of shareholder capital, and a healthy balance sheet, all of which reinforces our commitment to our investment teams, clients, and shareholders. I look forward to your questions. I will now turn it over to the operator for Q&A.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star and then two. At this time, we'll pause momentarily to assemble our roster. Our first question is from Michael Kim of Sandler O'Neill. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Good afternoon. First, just to follow up on some of your comments earlier, but just curious to get your current thoughts on trends you may be seeing in the institutional landscape in terms of de-risking or shifting into passive from an asset allocation standpoint, and then how those trends might be impacting your pipeline or RFP activity or what you're seeing in terms of sort of decision timelines more broadly.
Sure. Hey, Mike, it's Eric Colson. Our current thoughts are about what they were in the third and the fourth quarter. You know, we continue to see the institutional marketplace rebalancing. They still have an interest in passive. Primarily in the DC space, you see more and more passive getting inserted in the target dates to, you know, protect the proprietary nature of those funds. And we continue to see some of our clients exploring options to customize, seeing some interest in the middle market area of the DC space or institutional space that is showing some positive signs. But overall, the continued trend is passive investing, and I think we said on the call, you know, momentum was a big factor last year. Being in the index was a big factor, and that supported passive returns even more so. You know, fortunately, we've seen these cycles over the years, various factors and trends, and you know, the key for us is holding our ground and not chasing a short-term trend that doesn't fit our business model. But we would expect at some point there the passive side of the equation would fill up, and you'll see some balance back in the market.
Got it. That's helpful. And then just given sort of the decline in AUM for some of your franchises, just wondering if the teams have maybe started to see better investment opportunities out there, and you know what some of the potential implications could be for capacity across channels and strategies, and possibly reopening some of the strategies to more fully capitalize on some of those opportunities?
Well, we have no real change on capacity. Really, if you look at the teams, and CJ mentioned this on global equity and the growth team and the credit team are in a really good spot right now to capture trends for asset gathering, especially global equity and global opportunities. If you marry that with our overseas distribution, the credit team's in the early cycle there. The global value team is closed. We don't see any reason to reopen there, and the really leaves the U.S. value team and emerging markets. The U.S. value team, when you look at the mid-cap and the small-cap, still remain closed. Even if if you came up with a reopening on one of those, the strategy would be difficult to realize assets at this point. So we've always looked at realizable assets, and whether you open or close something is, they still have to, present a record and present traits that the assets would be realizable. So we have not made any decisions to open those two strategies.
Okay, and then just maybe one last one for CJ. The margins have held up more recently, but just sort of given some of the ongoing investment spending that you alluded to earlier and some of the AUM headwinds potentially in the near term and kind of factoring in sort of the ramp up in equity comp, just trying to get a sense of sort of the outlook for margins as you look out over the next year or two.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, our margin has improved nicely since we went public. I think we're at 40.6 around the IPO, and we've trended up to 45. As we continue to layer in equity-based comp grants, that's going to drive the margin down, a couple hundred basis points, and especially in this first quarter where we have these seasonal expenses, healthcare, 401k contributions, employer contributions, and reset on FICA. Our first quarter always is eroded 100 basis points or so. So, over time, we expect growth to offset those and work our way back up. But in the short term, you're going to see some margin pressure there, down into the lower 40.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking my questions.
Our next question is from Bill Katz of Citi. Please go ahead.
Okay, thanks, everyone. Good morning. I appreciate taking the questions. You mentioned that you're going to do some cautious marketing around the high-yield platform. Can you talk about the strategy of doing so, and you're going to tie the portfolio manager to it, or is it more sort of a branding opportunity? I'm just trying to understand the opportunity there.
Bill, you're talking about the high-income fund?
Yes.
Really around the high income fund, we see continued marketing into the intermediary channel. We saw early success there last year and into continued into this year. As we hit the 1 year track record, the intermediary channel really looks for that 1 year period to be able to put it onto their platform. So I think we'll see continued distribution efforts around the intermediary, and then also we're starting to get some inquiries on the institutional side that we're being reactive to, and I think with a one-year track record and over $500 million in the strategy, we're starting to meet the hurdles for many of the centralized research to put our strategy into a buying position. So we feel we're in a good spot with that strategy, and we'll continue to see growth.
Okay, that's helpful. Second question is, so looking at the slide that you lay out the non-U.S., and you want to show us both the AUM and the number of different relationships you have, and certainly a very nice trend, and maybe this is just bad math, but if you look at like the average size of the AUM per relationship, that number looks like it's sort of small, if you will. Now, I know you have markets and maybe FX dynamics affecting all that, Could you talk about how scalable that is at this point in time? Just sort of curious why, given a very strong ramp in a number of accounts and relationships, you haven't seen a steeper slope, if you will, in terms of the AUM lift against that.
You have a mixture of clients in that chart that shows the $13.9 billion in assets and 76 clients. And you see we've seen a few institutional clients go into the global opportunity strategy. And we've also seen us win some smaller accounts, but they're in the financial intermediary channel. So they seed those with some smaller allocations, and then we'll grow those with those advisors and brokers over time. So I think the last couple of months, we've seen a little bit more interest by the intermediary channel outside the U.S., and they start with a smaller allocation. So a few more accounts than normal, and so your average size is down. It's somewhat barbelled. Since you're new in the space, we either are getting attracted at the higher end, large institutional, or starting to ease into an intermediary.
Okay, and then last question. Thanks for taking all my questions. You didn't mention anything about the fee rate. It looks like it ticked down about a basis point sequentially. How much of that was maybe market forces versus mix, and what's the outlook going forward?
Yeah, I mean, we've been trending around 76, 77 basis points. It's a bit of rounding. We had some redemptions. We've seen some outflows in the U.S. value space, primarily in the fund, and that has a higher fee rate. So there isn't anything wholesale going on there. Early in the year, we saw assets flowing into our global equity team in the mutual fund space, intermediary space, and during the end of the year, we saw it, flowing out of, the outflows in the value team were coming from that space.
Okay. All right. Thanks for taking my questions.
Our next question is from Robert Lee of KBW. Please go ahead.
Thanks, and good morning, everyone. Just curious, and going back to maybe follow up to Bill's question on non-U.S. AUM, if I think back, with, say, global value, you first closed it to institutional relationships before you closed it to more broadly, I guess, to retail or in the fund business. So is there, as global equity, grows, as global opportunities where you said, has had good demand outside the U.S., is there anything on the horizon that we should be thinking about that some of those more successful strategies right now, given your desire to control the mix of clients, that could be some limiting factor on kind of growth outside the U.S. for a period of time?
Rob, it's Eric. Right now, the global opportunities has a nice mix. It has had quite a bit of interest from larger institutional clients, but we wouldn't. We're right now not thinking about shutting down a segment or a channel to skew the mix, so that would continue. And the global equity strategy is in, early phases there with, roughly $680 million in the strategy. That has quite a ways to go for that strategy. The global opportunities is a little over $5 billion. So we're not in a position on either one of those strategies that we would skew the mix. Versus global value today at over $15 billion. So I guess the short answer would be no.
Okay, and I'm just curious, on the RSUs or RSAs, the career shares, just curious how, when you award stock, how that, what the kind of mix is between those career shares and more traditional grants. And to make sure I understand it correctly, when you award a career share, say you awarded one on January 1st, those immediately start vesting, assuming there's some longevity criteria that's been met?
Yeah, I mean, from an accounting standpoint, we start, vesting the first year at the point of grant, so that layers in, the amortization layers in immediately. And the mix, you know, is generally on future grants going to be around 50-50. You know, this grant was primarily to investment teams, and they've sort of met our threshold for receiving career shares, so it was largely 50-50.
Okay, and maybe one last question, if I could. So, I mean, clearly, you know, you distributed about 100% of, you know, of the earnings this past year in 2014. But, I mean, looking forward, as you grant more shares, as you start to have kind of share count creep up, so to speak, you know, at what point or how do you start thinking about, you know, share repurchase as part of the capital management mix? Is that something we should be thinking could become more part of the conversation in 15 and 16? Just kind of trying to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's too early. We're still trying to build our float. You know, we're only, what, 18 months into you know, the IPO. So, you know, right now we're not discussing using any cash for share repurchase. You know, I do think it will at some point, probably, you know, another liquidity event or two to be a conversation, and we'll certainly, you know, try to give you guys, you know, a heads up, you know, when we're thinking about that, so you can sort of adjust your models. But, you know, either way, it's a return of capital to shareholders, just, you know, in a different form. So, you know, we certainly will consider it in the future, but we're not presently having those discussions.
Great. Thank you for taking my questions.
Our next question is from Michael Carrier of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Thanks, guys. Just wanted a quick question just on the build-out of strategies. So you brought on the credit strategy, and obviously it's relatively short, but it's been, you know, pretty successful, you know, from a short period of time. Just wanted to get your sense on, you know, the outlook over the next, you know, 1 to 3 years, you know, where the priorities are, you know, how active, you know, you plan on, you know, being, you know, and looking, you know, for any gaps or new talent.
Yeah, sure. It's Eric. And we feel that the credit team build out has gone very well, from back office to distribution to the investment resources, as well as the talent that we recruited to join Brian Krug. We've you know, seen over the last 12 months a very healthy dialogue going on in the marketplace with investment talent that you know, resides either in the emerging markets or emerging markets equity or debt. You know, we've seen a variety of alternative strategies that we feel fits into the high value added space or high degrees of freedom that we would call it, and that would fit quite nicely into our business model. And we continue to meet quite a few teams and individuals that you know, warrant follow-up discussions. So we will continue to meet with those groups. You know, it takes time to find the right team with the right alignment of interest into our business model and a strategy that we think fits long-term asset allocation. I think that last point, there's quite a bit of movement on in the asset allocation world of whether it's going to be a risk-based asset allocation or outcome-based asset allocation, and the growth into the high net worth marketplace warrants one of those two asset allocation models as opposed to the traditional asset allocation that we've all grown up and experienced with over the last 15, 20 years. So we're optimistic on it, but obviously we want to make sure we get it right, and it will take time.
Okay, thanks. And just as a follow-up, CJ, just in terms of you know, the foreign exchange, you know, moves that we've been, you know, seeing in the market, just want to get a sense. Each firm's a little different in terms of how they manage it or the impact that it can have, but both on the funds and then as you're building out the international distribution, just how does that, you know, have an impact on the business?
Yeah, there's a number of ways you know, FX touches us, and you know, on the translation of our AUM. We certainly saw a negative impact in the fourth quarter given the strengthening of the dollar, and you know, about 40% of our you know, assets are overseas. So it, you know, it was a bit more material this past quarter than it has historically been. You know, performance-wise, it runs through our market appreciation line, and really it's part of the investment process. From a P&L perspective, you know, obviously, you know, the lower AUM this quarter would impact that, because, you know, the way we bill on average assets. But from a P&L perspective, you know, our clients are largely billed here in U.S. dollars, and we only have a handful that are billed, you know, outside the U.S., so it's very immaterial from a P&L perspective.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Our next question is from Eric Berg of RBC. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. There was one concept that I was hoping, Eric, you could review from your prepared remarks. I just would like to deepen my understanding of this idea of securities in and out of the benchmark and how that affected your performance. And if you could just maybe just walk me through again the table on slide 6, maybe just picking one or two numbers from the table and as illustrations for how this table works. I need a little help understanding it. Thank you.
Sure, Eric. Now, first, on the in and out of index, and we did quite a bit of attribution across all of our strategies, and you know, some of our strategies, which we've highlighted in the past around emerging markets, invest in quite a few names that are not in the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. And given the asset flows into indexes and given the price momentum, there's been a nice upward push on the returns of those names versus names outside of the index. So, you know, if we had 30% of our portfolio of, say, of 100 stock portfolio, you know, those out of the index and those 30 stocks, you know, underperformed the index names by quite a bit. And then we went across all of our strategies and took a look at in index and out of index names. And for the most part, across every one of our strategies, the out of index names dramatically underperformed on average versus the names in the index, which would make sense given last year's you know, factor weighting towards momentum. With regards to the chart there, you know, we'll just take small cap value because it's the most extreme. But that first column there on small cap value, if you took the all the managers that ranked in the top quintile of their peer group during the bear market, so that April of 08 to March of 09, and took that group of managers and ranked them then during the current run, the current bull market run of March of 09 to now, that group of top quartile managers during the bear market on average was in the 88th percentile over the current run. And the managers that were performing in the bottom quintile of that bear market period during this bull market run are in the 18th percentile. And the quintile spread there is obviously the differential of 71. It was the most extreme market or the most extreme peer group there. And that's where we've seen our small cap value that did quite well during the bear market has been lagging during this bull market run. And we've always said we were going to participate in the bull market, but you know, the small cap value strategy is not a momentum oriented you know, strategy and has lagged quite a bit, and that's been the case for quite a few small cap value managers. Now we're not looking to make excuses here, but we just you know clearly think there's an exaggerated factor in the marketplace that's creating some endpoint exaggeration across the group.
Very good. That helps me out a lot. Thank you again.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question is from Chris Shutler of William Blair. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Good morning. First, I just wanted to get an update on the flows thus far in the month of January, recognizing that that's a very short period of time. And then on the institutional pipeline, just how that's looking. So RFPs, finals won, but not funded. Thanks.
Yeah, certainly, Chris. I think we're releasing our January flows in a couple of days here, and what we've been seeing so far is pretty much a consistent trend to what we saw in the third and fourth quarter. And I would say that's true for the pipeline as well, that institutional marketplace has been rebalancing, and third and fourth quarter results that we saw from flows and the third and fourth quarter pipeline is carrying into January.
All right, thanks, Eric. And then you touched on the appetite for potential new teams and meeting with several individuals and teams, but any update on the appetite of your existing teams to roll out new strategies?
You know, we're always in constant dialogue with our existing teams, but we have no near-term plans here to roll out a new strategy within any of the six teams right now.
Okay. And then just lastly, the global equity strategy sitting here at $680 million, top upper decile on a three-year basis. I think it hits its five-year here in April. I know you had the PM departure issue a couple of years ago, but what's the catalyst in your view for that taking off, because the long-term performance is very good?
Yeah, we think you are correct. The five-year number hits in March, at the end of March, so going into second quarter, we'll have a five-year record. And typically in the mid to large cap categories, you need a five-plus year record versus capacity-constrained areas such as small cap. The trigger is a three-year record, sometimes shorter, given the strategy. And with the five-year record and now $680 million in the strategy, and the performance over the last couple of quarters have been quite strong, and the time elapsed from our portfolio manager turn you brought up has been a couple of years, we think we're pretty well positioned there for growth, especially outside the U.S.
All right. Thank you.
This concludes our question and answer and conference call. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.